You're tuned to KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for joining us today. We're live tweeting the next hour at KUOW. We are going to tell you about a spike in suicides in Washington prisons coming up in about 10 minutes. But we're going to start this hour with the new Trump executive order on immigration. This revised order bans citizens from six majority Muslim countries from traveling to the United States. And to find out what this could mean for the Puget Sound region, we are joined by KUOW's immigration reporter, Liz Jones. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Bill.
What is different about this executive order?
Well, there's a lot that's different. We'll just hit some of the highlights here. It was mostly rewritten to address some constitutional questions that came up with version one and some legal challenges we saw there. One thing is the timeline. We have 10 days that this will roll out, so we don't have the immediate effect. We won't see the chaos at the airport maybe we saw the first time around. The list of banned countries you already mentioned, it's been narrowed down from 7 to 6. Iraq has been removed from that list. So, and then we look at current visa holders. It does not affect current visa holders or green card holders. This will apply to people who are seeking new visas to come here into the U.S., travelers from those 7 or those 6 banned countries. That could include people coming here for travel, for business, for study, for students. This will be a 90-day pause on issuing those new visas. So the government, what they say they want to do is review the security vetting processes for visas coming from those 6 countries. Another place we're going to see some effect is with refugees. The refugee resettlement program will be paused for 4 months. That's what we saw in the earlier version, so that's still the same. But it removes some language about religious preferences on which refugees get resettled here. Before, it would have effectively favored some Christians over Muslims in some of these countries. Another big change is that Syria no longer has an exclusive indefinite bar on resettlement here. So Syria is treated the same as the other refugees. And just one more thing on the refugees is that this still continues from the previous executive order. The cap on the number of refugees allowed to resettle here every year, that was lowered from 110,000 down to 50,000. It's still reduced to the 50,000 cap.
And Liz, what is the potential impact of this revised travel ban here in the Puget Sound region?
Yeah, so I guess talking first about refugees, our state has a goal this year to bring in 3,800 refugees, nearly 4,000 refugees. They're about halfway toward that goal, so 1,800 more still that might come in. If this 4-month pause goes into effect, it's really unclear what happens to those people still left in the queue. Agencies who resettle refugees here say those timelines get shifted back. You might have somebody who ages out of the system or their medical exam becomes expired. So they have to go back and start over on this process again. So it's really unclear how many more they'd be able to resettle after that suspension is lifted. The state's lawsuit said about 7,000 non-citizen people here, or non-citizen immigrants here, are affected. These are students, business travelers, all of that. We know from the earlier lawsuit, we saw a big tech response, right? We saw Amazon, Microsoft, Expedia join into Attorney General Bob Ferguson's lawsuit. Mm-hmm. They were a big part of, Ferguson gave them a lot of credit as to why this lawsuit went forward and why the judge eventually put the stay on it. And we saw here Judge Robart in the Ninth District upheld the lawsuit and agreed with Ferguson, saying that this does cause a lot of harm to employment, education, business, family, travel, and those harms are significant and ongoing.
And I know you're talking to people who might be affected, Liz. What are you finding out?
Well, one person I talked to was Rita Zawida, and she is the CEO. It's called SCM Medical Missions. They're based here in Seattle. It's a nonprofit that works with Syrian refugees overseas, primarily in Greece and in the refugee camp in Jordan. She also works with Syrian refugees here in Washington State as they're resettled here. We've had about 250 Syrian refugees settled here, not many, since this war started there 5 years ago. So she says these Syrian families here, they're mostly worried about family members overseas who might not be able to make it here.
Because they just don't know if the rest of the relatives are able to come in or not, or the other family members that were not with them that came, that are sitting waiting to be vetted to be able to come, you know, because the kids hit the age of 18 or over, so they're split from the family.
So then again, talking about this kind of timeline that people are on, you turn 18, you get your own refugee resettlement petition that goes forward, so you kind of get split off. And so this 4-month pause, that could go on quite a bit longer for people. And if the government decides the vetting is not at the place we want it to be. There's a lot of back and forth and changing the security processes or changing the vetting processes. That could be extended quite a period longer. It's very disruptive in the resettlement process. And another thing Rita Zawaida was talking about is that many Muslim immigrants and refugees here are asking, are we still welcome? Are we still safe? And she said she's particularly seen this from Syrians who were resettled in the Spokane area. There are about 27 families there. And she said that they're even afraid to open their doors.
They have asked, you know, that we make sure that we get them cell phones because the kids are taking public transportation to get to school. And they're very afraid for their kids. So they want their kids to be able to call if there's any type of problems at all.
So a little different maybe than the Seattle area where you do see large communities together and a little bit more community support.
Again, we're talking with KUOW immigration reporter Liz Jones. Finally, Liz, after the president signed the first travel ban, Washington State, we became the epicenter of the legal fight against it. What do we expect to happen this time around?
Well, we know the first executive order was rescinded, so that is off the table. And what we expected was that these legal challenges would probably be moot because it's no longer a document to be fighting over. But legal challenges are expected. Attorney General Bob Ferguson is holding a press conference right now to talk about what's next on that. So we'll have more details on that later. Our reporter Ruby DeLuna is there and will be bringing us updates later in the day. And just looking at the constitutional questions here, I think some of those, what we're hearing is those don't go away. Those will still be debated. And to just tease out those issues a little bit, there's a constitutional question here of the president has pretty broad authorities when it comes to immigration and setting guidelines on immigration. But the Constitution and Congress also says you can't discriminate on religion or nationality, country of origin. Mm-hmm. So those are two things that are kind of butting heads right now. And we'll see how much this new executive order addresses some of those constitutional questions on religion and what the courts have to say about that.
KUOW's immigration reporter, Liz Jones. Thank you, Liz.
Thank you.
We're looking forward to hearing from the state attorney general, Bob Ferguson, about this. We will tell you more about the travel ban later this afternoon. Will it be easier to defend in court, whether it's Washington State challenging it or not? Also this afternoon, President Trump claims without evidence that former President Obama tapped his phones at Trump Tower, and bidding opens this week for companies wanting to build Trump's southern border wall. That and more coming up this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. KUOW 94.9 Seattle, news and information. You know the saying, everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it? That's not actually true at several Western airports. Ground crews do take action when freezing fog threatens takeoffs and landings. Correspondent Tom Bonsi introduces us to an unusual fog-busting system.
Think back to the last time you were at the theater or at a rock concert and make-believe fog wafted over the stage. That special effect was probably created with dry ice. Bet you didn't know, though, you can also use dry ice to clear away real fog.
From dry ice, it collects the moisture, falls to the ground as basically just snow or ice.
Howard Volkman is the operations supervisor at Rogue Valley International Medford Airport. He and several co-workers show me what happens when Mother Nature throws travelers a curveball and freezing fog descends over the airport. First, they load crushed dry ice into a hopper suspended under a big helium balloon.
You guys ready?
The 18-foot diameter balloon is tethered with a winch cable to an airport pickup truck.
We detach from the vehicle and let the tether hang on to it, and we fly the balloon at about 500 feet.
Volkman says a driver and an operator make loops around the runway with the balloon and its dry ice spreader in tow.
And we're basically driving along 5 to 7 miles an hour, and we're clearing a hole in the fog just for the airplanes to be able to see the runway.
Volkman says this fog-busting method only works at temps of 32 degrees and below, so that's not that useful for airports in coastal cities where it's usually warmer when fog forms. Medford Airport Director Byrne Case says the staff nicknamed their white balloon Casper after the friendly cartoon ghost, Casper has deployed 14 times this winter. Case describes it as very effective. It reduced flight cancellations to near zero.
It's all about dollars. Cancellations and diversions for airlines are very expensive, not only to the airlines, but if a person's trying to get to Tokyo and they can't get out of here, it can ruin an entire trip.
Case says the Medford Airport provided the blueprints for the one-of-a-kind balloon system to the airport authorities in Spokane and Anchorage. Casper is on its eighth winter of tweaking and improvement. At Anchorage International, manager John Parrott says his airport inquired early on when it stopped using a hired small plane carrying shaved dry ice to attack fog.
Using their technique with a pickup truck would have been significantly cheaper than having an airplane fly it over, but even at that, we just no longer had a requirement. The older aircraft that needed the help have all been mothballed.
Anchorage and other Western airports such as Salt Lake City and Reno that once actively fought winter fog no longer do. Parrott says recent advances in precision navigation technology mean newer jets can take off and land with barely any visibility.
We talked to the airlines and we all came to the conclusion there was just not a good business case for continuing this.
One other airport worth mentioning is Missoula, Montana. Its staff still try to clear away freezing fog, but not with a balloon-based system like Medford invented. When the need arises in Missoula, 2 to 4 trucks sweep down the runway spraying super-cooled liquid carbon dioxide to disperse fog that impedes regional jets. I'm Tom Bonsi in Medford, Oregon.
This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We were telling you a few minutes ago, Washington State's Attorney General Bob Ferguson is reacting to President Trump's new executive order on immigration, the so-called travel ban. You know, the last travel ban led to chaos at airports and a successful legal challenge from Washington State's Attorney General. Well, Bob Ferguson says by rescinding his earlier executive order, President Trump makes one thing perfectly clear. His original travel ban was indefensible legally, constitutionally, and morally. Ferguson goes on to say the president has capitulated on numerous key provisions blocked by our lawsuit. And Ferguson says that he is reviewing the new executive order to determine its impacts on the state and next legal steps. We'll tell you more when we know more here on KUOW Seattle. Washington State's prison system had a spike in inmate suicides. In 2014 and 2015, 11 inmate deaths were ruled suicide, giving Washington one of the highest prison suicide rates in the country. KUOW's Austin Jenkins has spent the past year investigating how this happened and what the prison system is doing about it. In part one of his series now, Austin takes us inside one prison. And I want you to know in advance, this story includes descriptions of suicides.
This is what it sounds like when there's a suicide in prison. You're hearing two-way radio traffic from the Washington Corrections Center on the morning of October 16th, 2014. An inmate named Nicholas White had been found hanging in his two-man cell. It was the 31-year-old's second time behind bars. There's an urgency in the voices of the prison staff. And there is tension.
I've got the security key. Go pick up medical staff north end of the infirmary. Bring them to R2.
That morning had started out routinely. Surveillance video shows shirtless inmates playing basketball in a gym. You can hear the idle chatter of correctional officers in an office off the gym. They talk about how the microphone on the camera will burn them someday. You can actually hear them say that. Then White's cellmate stops by, and you can hear his voice in the videotape, too.
I'm at 8-4, lower. My cellmate's name is Nicholas White.
The cellmate tells a sergeant that White has been acting paranoid and talking about killing himself.
This morning, like with Vince, sorry, he's trying to tie his little sheet up there to see if he'll stay.
Cool. Okay. Have a good day.
All right.
About 15 minutes elapses from when the cellmate alerts the staff to when the call for help goes out over the radio. Even as the emergency response begins, everything else goes on as normal. The basketball game continues. The inmates in the gym have no idea one of their own is hanging in a nearby cell.
CPR in progress. CC base, CPR in progress.
WCC base received CPR in progress, 1003.
At 10:20 a.m., a prison doctor declares White dead. In the office where the video is running, someone in the office announces, "The dude is dead." A handheld video from that day shows the ambulance crew leaving. White's body remains on the floor outside of his cell. A correctional officer walks up and places a white sheet over the body. Someone is heard saying, "It's an unfortunate day." White was the fifth Washington prison inmate to die by suicide in 2014. In a normal year, two, maybe three inmates would take their own lives. This spike set off alarm bells within the Department of Corrections, but not immediately.
We started seeing an increase, and I would say at around the fourth suicide, we started to become concerned. It was different than previous years.
This is Dr. Carrie Rayner, who directs mental health services for the Washington Department of Corrections. Rayner says up until this point, she and her team had been viewing these suicides in isolation. Now, they started to look for patterns, for commonalities.
While we were looking at that, then of course we continued to have suicides that were completed, which just further raised our concerns, and we were taking a closer look.
After Nicholas White, there was one more suicide in 2014, and then in 2015, five more inmates took their own lives. If there was a pattern to these deaths, it wasn't easily detectable. The victims were housed in different prisons. They were different ages. They'd committed different crimes. Some were serving long sentences. Others were about to get out. Some had known mental health issues. Others weren't on anyone's radar. So who were these men? The first was Richard Billings Jr., age 38. He was found hanging in his cell at the Stafford Creek Correction Center near Aberdeen just after 3 one morning. Billings was serving a 12-year sentence for child molestation. He had a history of suicide attempts throughout his life. Just prior to his death, he'd been taken off suicide watch at the prison and moved to a single cell. His therapist later told investigators that Billings should not have been placed in a single cell given his suicidal tendencies. The next was Tony Willoughby, age 48. He hanged himself at the Airway Heights prison near Spokane in April. Willoughby was serving life without parole for murdering an 87-year-old woman. He'd been in prison for nearly 3 decades. The following month, in the same prison, Morgan Bluehorse, age 29, was discovered hanging by a sheet from the sprinkler head protection cage in his isolation cell. He was serving 15 years for a string of burglaries, and he too had a history of suicide attempts dating back to his childhood. In August, also at Airway Heights, Chance Kidder, age 19, hanged himself from the sprinkler head protection cage in his isolation cell. Kidder was nearing the end of his 14-month sentence for auto theft. Then it was Nicholas White at the Washington Correction Center, the inmate who was found shortly after his cellmate alerted staff. It turns out White had tried to get help. An investigation revealed that 3 days before his death, he had asked to see a mental health counselor. The next day, he submitted another request and said he wanted to get back on his medications ASAP. The day of his death, White had an appointment to see a counselor, but it appears no one let him know the appointment had been set up. The sixth and final suicide of that year was also at the Washington Correction Center. Keith Neal, age 43, was serving a 35-year sentence for multiple counts of child rape. The night before his death, Neal was honored by prison volunteers for his work as a teaching assistant in the education department at the prison.
It's R2. WCC base received R2.
After each of these suicides, the Washington Department of Corrections conducted what's called a critical incident review. This is basically an investigation into what happened and whether policies were followed. The review includes timelines, interviews with staff, and it concludes with recommendations and lessons learned. But despite these reviews, the suicides didn't stop. The first 3 months of 2015 brought 3 more suicides. In January, Oscar Garcia Pacheco, age 34. In February, 23-year-old Nathan Bennett. In March, Jason Williams. He was 41. It was around this time that top staff at the Washington Department of Corrections decided they needed to ask for some help. That's when then Corrections Secretary Bernie Werner picked up the phone and called Lindsay Hayes.
I've worked in the field of suicide prevention in correctional facilities for more than 35 years.
Hayes is with the Baltimore-based National Center on Institutions and Alternatives. He's viewed as one of the nation's preeminent experts on jail and prison suicide, and he agreed to come out to Washington.
So that was my task going forth, and I went out there and spent 4 days on site and went to four different prisons.
Washington has nearly 17,000 inmates housed in 12 different prisons, from Clallam Bay on the northwest coast to the state penitentiary at Walla Walla to the women's prison at Purdy. After his visit, Hayes wrote a 47-page report. We'll hear more about his findings later, but for now, consider this statistic found on page 4. During a 3-year period ending in June of 2015, Washington prisons had a suicide rate of nearly 24 deaths per 100,000 inmates. That is much higher than the average suicide rate in prisons, and nearly double the rate of suicide outside of prison. If you think about it, suicide should be less of a problem in prison because many of the means have already been removed. For instance, there's no access to guns, the leading method of suicide in the U.S. And yet, suicide is an ever-lurking danger in prisons. The inmates are locked up and deprived of social support systems. Many have an underlying mental health condition or have experienced childhood trauma, or both.
This is a Global Tel Link collect call from an inmate at Monroe Correctional Complex.
Consider the case of Daniel J. Perez.
I'm 30 years old, and I'm at Monroe Correctional Complex Special Offenders Unit.
The Special Offender Unit is for inmates with serious mental health issues. Perez says his diagnosis is schizoaffective disorder and PTSD. He has a history of self-harm and suicide attempts. Perez first went to prison at age 18 for vehicular homicide. In prison, he says he became paranoid and violent. Less than a year into his sentence, he murdered his cellmate, strangled him to death. Perez spent the next nearly 3 years in solitary confinement, locked down 23 hours a day. He was getting mental health treatment during this time, but even so, he says the isolation took a toll.
And that's when my self-harm and suicidal ideations came back.
In 2009, Perez was moved out of isolation and into the Special Offender Unit at Monroe. But a few months later, he attempted to murder another fellow inmate. Once again, he was put back into solitary confinement, this time for 5 more years. 2 years into this stint in isolation, he attempted suicide.
So I ripped up a sheet, made a ligature, and wrapped it around my neck so tight that I lost consciousness.
Perez woke up in the hospital. He had been saved by prison staff who performed CPR on him for about 30 minutes. Perez says he attempted suicide because of the isolation.
The walls close in on you. They collapse on you. You feel detached. It's an overwhelming feeling of anxiety, depression, and paranoia.
Prison suicide expert Lindsay Hayes estimates that only 10, maybe 20% of prison inmates are in segregation at any given time. But he says they represent 30 to 40%, maybe more, of the suicides. In Washington, 4 of the inmates who completed suicide in 2014 and 2015 were in segregation at the time of their deaths. And at least 6 of the 11 had done time in segregation. While studies have shown that segregation can be psychologically damaging, it's also supposed to be physically safe. Chance Kidder, a 19-year-old inmate who hanged himself in a segregation cell at Airway Heights, wasn't safe. Tomorrow, in part 2, you'll hear the story of a young inmate who grew up as a foster kid in Central Washington, got in trouble with the law, and died by suicide in a segregation cell just days before his release. That's tomorrow in part 2. I'm Austin Jenkins reporting.
More tomorrow of Austin's series called Suicide Behind Bars. This is KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Your child's happiness, their success in life, is all that a measure of how great you are at parenting? Child psychologist Allison Gopnik says we've come to think so, but it shouldn't be that way. In her book, The Gardener and the Carpenter, Gopnik calls on you to reconsider what it means to be a parent.
The very word parenting and the concept that goes with it is remarkably recent. So it's really only in the 1970s that the word became popular. And that word comes with a kind of picture. And the picture is that there's some set of expertise or techniques that people could acquire that would help them shape their child into a particular kind of child and thus into a particular kind of adult. And we just take that for granted in our culture, but it's actually an unusual and recent picture about what relationships between parents and children should be like. And more to the point, what led me to write this book is that it's very different from the picture that comes out of the science, and especially some really exciting recent science.
Well, then what's another model of being a parent that's not parenting?
So you could think of the parenting model as being kind of thinking of being a parent as being like a carpenter. You have a particular kind of material, and if you just have the right kind of expertise and tools, you'll be able to shape it into a particular chair. And the model that comes out of the science is instead that caregivers are designed to give children, give young human beings a protected period, a space in which they can explore new possibilities, do things that have never been done before. So even if you could accomplish the parenting model goal of shaping your child to come out a particular way, you'd be defeating the whole evolutionary and psychological point of childhood by doing it. It's more like a gardener who doesn't know what's going to happen in the garden, but tries to create a resilient, dynamic ecosystem that can respond to changes in the weather and seasons in somewhat unpredictable ways. That's a better picture of what being a parent is all about.
Well, of course, when you garden, if one of your plants dies, you just plant another one. How can we be gardeners when we want so desperately for that plant to thrive?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the dilemma. So parents do and should care about their children and care about their future and care about what's going to happen to them. But, you know, if you think about it more deeply, if you think about the way that we care for our children, if the only reason we cared for our children was because we wanted them to come out a particular way, you know, we'd go out and find the children that were the most promising and just put all our love and affection into them. And that's not what being a parent is like. Part of what makes being a parent so profound and important is that we love that child kind of independently of whatever their particular features and properties are. And I think that unconditional commitment is exactly the kind of emotion, the kind of feeling that we have that enables us to care about that child and care for that child sort of independently of how they turn out in the end.
You write that Americans used to learn to be parents by doing it before we got there. How did that happen?
Well, for most of human history, the way that you learned how to care for a child was by caring for children yourself. I talk a lot in the book about the new work in evolutionary biology about the origins of childhood. And we really evolved to raise children in this extended family where there were a lot of people all involved and invested in the care of these children. And our children are dependent and immature for much longer than the children of any other species. And one of the side effects of that was that by the time we had children ourselves, we'd taken care of our younger siblings, younger cousins. We'd seen our aunts and our uncles and other older siblings take care of children. We had a lot of experience in caregiving. And it's really only in that same 30 years when parenting was on the rise that that wasn't true anymore, that people were having children for the first time when they were 40, when they'd spent a long time working and going to school, but they hadn't actually had any experience of caring for children themselves. So it's no wonder that they thought, well, this is like working. I can get expertise from people who know more than I do, and that will tell me how to do this. And there's a $1 billion parenting industry that's the result.
You know, Allison, my father probably didn't consult any experts, and what my father taught me was to explode in derisive anger, and I feel like I learned a lot from experts. So, you know, what's so bad about experts?
Well, there's nothing wrong about experts. We all try and get help anywhere that we can, but I think it should be reassuring and liberating for parents to know that essentially if they follow their intuitions, love their children, pass on the values that are important to them, the children will do the rest. The children can take the information that's out there in the world around them. The other part of the science in the book are amazing new studies showing just how sensitive and subtle children are in the way that they learn from adults. So, you know, I'm looking at you now. I'm not seeing explosive anger. Somehow you managed to take all that information from the people around you and turn it into something different, turn it into something new. And that's what childhood is all about. Childhood is about taking what the previous generation did and remixing and changing and altering it so that we come up with something new. And being a caregiver is loving children enough, providing enough of a warm, safe, stable environment that they can explore in those kinds of ways.
What's your take on kids and computers?
Yeah, so I have a whole chapter about kids and technology in the book, and I'm much more optimistic than I think a lot of cultural commentators are. So there's quite a lot of panic about children and screens and computers. And of course, we won't know for another 20 years what the effects are going to be. But if we look at it from a historical perspective, there's been panic every time there's been a new technology. And I think there's actually an interesting scientific reason for that, which is that adults really do have a hard time mastering new technologies. So for adults, it feels like something like the internet is disruptive and attention demanding and just difficult. But I think we have lots of evidence that for children, even children's brains are designed to master new technologies in a much more effortless and spontaneous way. And the result of that is that, as I say in the book, you know, the day before you were born always looks like Eden, and the day after your children were born always looks like Mad Max. So the technology that you were born with doesn't look like technology. It just looks like stuff. And the technology that your children are engaged in looks like scary, new, difficult technology. And, you know, if you read reactions even to writing, to printing, to the train, to the telegraph, to the television, that same kind of panic happens over and over again. And it's interesting because, again, what the science suggests is the very point of childhood, the very point of that long protected period, is to give human beings this time to invent and master new technologies. We've been doing that ever since we were human. Part of what makes us human is our ability to have culture, pass on tools to a new generation, to have each new generation do something different from the previous generation, and to have the previous generation say that the world is going to hell in a handbasket at the same time.
Can you share an aha moment from your own experience being a parent?
Oh, well, one thing is perhaps the biggest, most relevant aha at the moment for me is being a grandparent. So becoming a grandmother, definitely an aha moment for me was that, you know, when you're actually giving birth, there's a million things that are happening to you physically and biologically. So this baby comes out and you're madly in love with the baby. The aha for me was I was a grandmother. I was exactly the same person 2 days after my grandson was born as I was before, except that now I was a person who would give my life for this baby. And that moment of realizing that, you know, it's not that you take care of these children because you love them. It's that you love them because you care for them. The way that just caring for this baby could really transform your whole attitude towards the world and yourself. That was a pretty, and could do it without pregnancy, without hormones, without any of that. That was a serious aha moment for me.
So in your estimation, Allison, what do children need?
Well, I think the three things that young children need are mud, livestock, and relatives. And
mud, livestock, and relatives.
They need a place to play, something that they can explore physically, a biological world that they can explore and be part of. That's the garden. And they need people, not just one person, but a lot of people who care about them and for them. And in an urban society, mud, livestock, and relatives tend to be in sort of short supply. But if you look at something like a great early childhood education program, a great preschool or childcare, you can see that we provide the equivalent of that. We can have sandboxes and guinea pigs and really excellent preschool teachers. They do the same thing. They give children a rich physical environment that they can physically explore. They give children a chance to be part of the natural and biological world. And they give children grown-ups who care about them, which is probably the most important thing in children's development.
Sometimes it's helpful when someone tells me to stop doing something because I can picture and recognize when I'm doing it. Is there one thing you want parents to stop? Don't do that.
Well, I think stop worrying about whether what you're going to do now is going to affect your children 20 years from now. And that's something that's very hard to avoid. I certainly have not managed to avoid it in raising my own children. It's a very natural way to think. But it isn't very well supported by the data. You can't tell what's going to happen to your children 20 years from now. There's not going to be any straightforward relationship between the little decisions that you make now and what happens to them 20 years from now. So a much better way to think about it is my child thriving now? And what can I do to make my child and me thrive in this particular relationship at this particular moment with this particular child and this particular parent?
Allison Gottmik, child psychologist. Her book, The Gardener and the Carpenter, asks you to rethink what it means to be a parent. We are tweeting out a link to her TED Talk about how babies think. We're tweeting that out now. She calls babies and young kids the research and development division of the human species. We're tweeting at KUOW on Twitter. And coming up on KUOW, when Americans name the most famous feminists, three of the top four are African-American: Michelle Obama, Oprah, and Beyoncé. We're going to look into what it means to have three women of color as the new face of feminism. That's today on KUOW's All Things Considered. In the Northeast, bats started dying by the millions a decade ago. It was a disease that for years stayed pretty much confined to the eastern U.S. and Canada. But last year, it mysteriously and suddenly appeared in the Pacific Northwest. Ever since, researchers have been racing to find out what bats here are in for. Reporting for EarthFix, Michael Werner has the story.
A very annoyed bat squeaks and wriggles about John Huckabee's gloved hands. The wildlife veterinarian carefully unfolds its wing and searches for signs of infection.
There are a few small, depigmented areas of scarring on the wing, but overall looks like he's in very good shape.
This bat appears healthy. But last spring, a not-so-lucky bat was brought to Huckabee's office outside Seattle.
One of the wings had some wounds, some lesions on the wing, and had an appearance like it may have a fungal infection.
The odd scarring was a symptom of white nose syndrome, one of the deadliest wildlife diseases in modern times. The syndrome is named for the fuzzy white fungus that grows on the bat's muzzles. Bats with white nose wake up more often during hibernation, and they burn through fat reserves needed for winter. Starvation and death soon follow. Since it was first discovered in 2006, the syndrome has killed almost 6 million bats. Jeremy Coleman is the National White Nose Disease Coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
We weren't aware that that was going to be a problem until 2008, when the problem spread to several sites throughout eastern New York and into western New England.
Scientists had hoped the natural barrier of the Rocky Mountains would protect West Coast bats, but it somehow jumped more than 1,300 miles to the forest east of Seattle.
We don't know how white nose syndrome came to be in Washington State, and that's obviously an area that we are investigating now.
Some speculate that an infected bat hitched a ride on a truck bound for Washington. Others think hikers or cavers carried the fungus on their clothes or equipment. Since the first infected bat was found in Washington, the white-nose fungus has been detected twice more, both near the original site around North Bend. Fear of an outbreak has sent researchers around the Northwest scrambling to learn about their bat populations before the disease takes hold. Ecologist Tom Rothaus and a team of researchers have been studying bats in Central Oregon.
We've gone for decades without really understanding what's happening with bats.
In a high desert canyon, Rothaus and the team erect a series of nets like the ones used in badminton, only with a finer mesh. Once night falls, it doesn't take long.
We have bats in the net.
The researchers disentangle their tiny captive. They check the health, sex, and species of the bat, and then set it free. They're trying to learn what species are present and how big the populations are.
There's really no way for us to ascertain what's happening with our bat populations without this kind of a coordinated, large-scale survey effort.
It's been nearly a year since white nose was first discovered in Washington. Since then, no large-scale die-offs have been seen around the Northwest. Scientists say the natural tendencies of Western bats may help slow the disease's spread. Eastern bats congregate during hibernation, sometimes by the thousands. Since the disease spreads primarily by bat-to-bat contact, it can wreak havoc in these large colonies. But bat researcher Abby Tobin says Western bats don't hibernate together in large groups.
We have a little more hope in Washington that our bats might not be infected as much as bats in Eastern North America have been.
These small differences in behavior may be what ultimately saves Western bats. But it could be years before definitive answers emerge. In Seattle, I'm Michael Werner reporting.
KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Now, earlier this hour, we told you about President Trump signing the new executive order today on immigration. Of course, the last immigration order was followed by airport chaos at SeaTac and other airports and by that successful legal challenge led by Washington State. So the new travel ban would temporarily keep out visa seekers from six, not seven, Muslim-majority nations. Iraq's off the list. The order suspends the U.S. refugee program and removes the religious test, which we'll talk about more this afternoon on All Things Considered. Anyway, Washington's attorney general is reviewing that order. Meanwhile, there might be another executive order coming on immigration, one that would restrict H-1B visas. Local tech companies, your Microsoft, your Amazon, etc., they use H-1B visas to bring in software engineers and other skilled workers. From the tech news site GeekWire, here is co-founder Todd Bishop. Hiya, Todd.
How's it going, Bill?
Good, good. Thank you. First of all, what does President Trump have against the H-1B visa program?
The concern, not only by President Trump, but among others, the unions who have tried to organize the tech industry historically have raised this same concern.
Right.
Is that it's taking jobs away from American workers. If you import essentially highly skilled, high-tech workers from other countries, no matter how skilled they are, it can take those jobs away.
And drive down wages if they're paid less, right?
That's absolutely right. And that there is some evidence to suggest that that does happen.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions called H-1B visas a tremendous threat to American workers. And as you said, it's kind of a bipartisan issue. How right do you think that assessment is?
It really depends on which companies you're talking about. We just had a great piece on GeekWire by our contributor, Drew Atkins, who really differentiated between the outsourcing firms, the Infosys's and the Tatas of the world.
Of India.
Right. Yeah. Actually, they end up applying for many more H-1B visas than companies like Microsoft, Amazon, Google. That said, Microsoft among those individual companies is one of the highest applicants for H-1B visas.
Something like 4,000 in 2016?
Yeah, they actually were awarded 4,000 in 2016. And so then the question becomes sort of where do you draw the line? And what Trump's executive order, the draft that was obtained by Bloomberg News, suggested was that companies would be required to offer jobs to Americans first. And then if they could not fill the jobs domestically, then they would be able to offer them through H-1B visas, bringing in foreign workers, but focusing on the highest paid to leave some of those entry-level jobs for Americans.
Doesn't Microsoft claim that there are not enough American workers with the education and the skills they need?
That's correct. And this is where you get into a little bit of the difference between some of the very high-end research that companies like Microsoft are doing. You know, they're driving the technology forward, whereas with companies like Infosys and others, they might be supplying workers who would be doing basic line of business applications for big companies, whereas you know they're more implementing the technology versus actually inventing new technologies.
Less skilled, less educated, less well paid.
That's right.
So my understanding is the company has a lot of bargaining power over a foreign worker because it's up to the employer to sponsor the worker for a green card if they choose to. Have you heard that too?
Yes, absolutely. And that is one of the risks and one of the interesting dynamics that has created this influx of workers under the H-1B program. And it'll be fascinating to see what Trump can do, because there's also initiatives in Congress to overhaul H-1Bs.
Right. You reported on that in GeekWire. What are some of the other ideas there are out there?
So one idea would be to end the lottery and focus instead on people who were actually educated here. So if you came here to get a computer science degree, you could be getting more of advantage in the H-1B selection process to stay here and actually help companies here locally or in the United States.
And what's the benefit of that?
The idea there would be you would actually have a natural winnowing process that these folks would have essentially pre-qualified themselves. You know, they're being, in some cases, they're being educated by these American universities. So why not have them stick around and benefit the U.S. economy as well?
So if the feds were to restrict Microsoft and Amazon, et cetera, their use of H-1B visas, how big a deal would that be for their hiring here?
So if you look at Microsoft's 4,000 number, just as a good example, to put that in context, Microsoft is, you know, I think they're at about 120,000 people worldwide, mm-hmm. about 40,000 people in the Puget Sound region. And so that gives you a sense. It's roughly 10% of the workforce here in the Seattle area, if all of them were to come here. So it's a significant impact. It's certainly not devastating, but it's the kind of thing that could ripple through the company's business. I'm just hearing from folks inside some of these companies over the weekend, there was actually a move to restrict the premium processing of H-1B visas, which is the time.
The rush that Amazon's and Microsoft's put on these applications.
Right. Right now, they can pay to have them expedited. That is going to end very soon. So it's a difference between a couple weeks and a few months for these applications to be processed. And even with that, talking with some of the people inside the companies, they don't think it's going to have a huge impact on them. They're certainly watching this closely, but they're actually hoping that that will fill out the backlog, that will clear out the backlog and make it easier for them to get future H-1B applications through.
Do you think that a restriction on the H-1B visas that favors higher paid workers, would that do anything to make salaries rise at our local tech companies?
You know, it's interesting. I think any restriction on H-1B visas could make salaries rise, because naturally you're further reducing the inbound supply of workers and, mm-hmm. and thereby, you know, essentially making the salaries go up. And, you know, if you look at the struggles that all companies are having here in the Seattle region and in Silicon Valley to hire engineers, there is a case, a very strong case to be made that there's a scarcity of engineers. So I think it's important for the tech industry, for this H-1B visa program to still be there, but to be used more selectively in a way that doesn't damage domestic workers.
We're talking with the co-founder of the Seattle-based tech news site GeekWire and talking about possible changes coming maybe from an executive order. There are bills in Congress to change the way local tech companies like Microsoft and Amazon use H-1B visas to bring in skilled workers. What else should we know to be smart about all these arguments swirling around?
It really does come down to the specific tactics used by each company. And we've got a good chart that shows who does what, essentially. And it's the difference in volume between the individual tech companies and the relatively low number of H-1B visas that they go after and the consulting companies. And so I think it's important, no matter what the policy ends up being, that people understand the difference between those two approaches.
GeekWire's Todd Bishop. Good to talk with you, Todd. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Bill.
It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. So as we said earlier, the president is restricting travel from countries he thinks are a terrorism risk. The new executive order removes language that appears to give priority to Christian immigrants, but it still focuses on Muslim-majority countries. So is it a Muslim ban? And what about what experts say is a bigger threat, Americans who could become radicalized? We're going to get into all of that today on KUOW's All Things Considered.